Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, supported by DownloadTennis.com. On today's tour catch-up,
Jannik Sinner strolls to the title in Antwerp.
Annette Kontaveit's comeback seals the Moscow crown.
And Emma Raducanu gears up for the Transylvania Open.
Kim, another round of tournaments on the ATP and WTA tours. We are finally in the home straight, it feels like, post-Indian Wells, back in Europe, and we've got a lot of tennis to talk about. We're in the indoor season, mostly. I mean, Tenerife was outdoors. I mean, it looked beautiful there, but really the name of the game at the moment for a lot of players around 10 or so in the world, I think, is ranking points. And really, at the moment, it is a big opportunity for all these players to get ranking points on the board, whether that means going to Guadalajara for the WTA end of season tour finals or Turin for the ATP end of season finals. It feels like ranking points are the name of the game at the moment.
Indeed, yeah, tail end of the season and it's all to play for a select few players, and for everyone else it's kind of like, yeah, I'll try and get a title, get my ranking up before the start of next season. Maybe some players have probably checked out and they're just, you know, looking forward to their Christmas holidays, in which case I do not blame them. We all need a bit of a break, don't we?
Were you thinking Muguruza in mind after that 6-1 loss to Kontaveit in Moscow?
Well, she wasn't very happy with the weather in Moscow, so perhaps that played a factor. She should have gone and played Tenerife and, you know, felt a bit more at home.
She would have been right at home in Tenerife. And I mean, given Svitolina went out so early, I think the organisers would have loved to have an SOS call to Muguruza with the what looked like some really glorious weather, actually, in Tenerife.
Oh, no, it's making me, you know, long for the Spanish sun. but yeah, it's, you know, we'll get on to Tenerife in a bit. Let's start with Moscow over for the women with the Kremlin Cup, because one player certainly made the most of her week, and that is Annette Kontaveit, because she won her third title of the year. She came back from a set and four love down in the final against Ekaterina Alexandrova, winning 7-5 in the third set. So very close affair. But she's really on a roll. It's her third title of the year, but her fifth final overall, and all of that's come in the last few months, so she's really making the most of this particular phase of the year and is now on a 10 match win streak indoors, and she's looking very, very difficult to beat at the moment, and definitely the informed player on the WTA tour.
Yeah, she's been really, really impressive over the last few tournaments, and she's putting herself in with a shout, actually, to, you know, be in Guadalajara for the WTA end of season finals. Ongjabeur has pulled out of Courmayeur this week, and, you know, she retired actually in the first round against Alexandrova in Moscow, and that really, I think, helped Kontaveit in terms of that feeling that she could, you know, potentially, you know, be there. And she's really put this fantastic run together that has stretched over the last few months. It's come out of nowhere for me, you know, a little bit. I feel like she's a player who, I feel like she, you know, we know that she's a very, very good tennis player, but not necessarily has always been able to kind of put these sorts of streaks together. But at the moment, yeah, she's absolutely fine form. And in that final, I mean, against Alexandrova on home territory, 6-4, 4 love down. That is very impressive stuff. And you just felt that for Alexandrova, this was a match that, I mean, of course, this was a match that got away from her. I felt like the nerves maybe got a bit better of her, particularly in that third set. I think she was a breakup twice, wasn't able to hold on to it. And it just, I think, shows you the confidence and the belief, I think, that Kontaveit is playing with at the moment, because she really does have a, you know, never say die attitude, and she really needed it in that final, and perhaps with the, you know, the motivation of potentially getting to the WTA Tour finals, that potentially helped to get her over the line.
Yeah, quite a few momentum shifts in that final. And I think it just came down to being able to execute, you know, when it got really tight on those key points and, you know, push came to shove, Kontaveit was able to do that. And I think it probably didn't help Alexandrova that she, you know, has had a couple of retirements en route to the final. She's had, generally speaking, a bit of an easier pathway, which I always feel, you know, doesn't really get you so up for a fight. I mean, I suppose Kontaveit also has had an easy pathway, but perhaps she's a bit more battle-hardened from all her match wins of late. But I think, you know, Kontaveit, yeah, she has got to win the Transylvania Open in Cluj this week in order to pass Jabeur in the race and qualify for the WTA final. So she has to win Cluj. And I mean, given her current form and you know, win rate, that's not looking that unlikely. So it's all on her, really. She could overtake, yeah, Jabeur and qualify.
I mean, this in theory is the tougher draw. I mean, this is a WTA 500 and there were some real, you know, obstacles, I think, in the way. And, you know, you looked at her draw and you thought, you know, Garbiñe Muguruza, second seed against Kontaveit in the quarterfinals. And you thought, you looked at that matchup and you thought, oh, this could be quite a tight contest. And you, perhaps you might have favoured Muguruza to come through, but absolutely not. I watched a bit of the highlights earlier, Kim. Kontaveit coming through 6-1, 6-1 against the second seed Garbiñe Muguruza. I mean, what happened there? I know we jokingly spoke about the cold weather. We know that Muguruza was posting earlier in the week. She's hating the cold. And I think she may have found out that, you know, she had qualified for the end of season finals. Maybe that was playing on her mind. She just wanted to get out of there. But yeah, in the highlights, she just did not look really that motivated. She was throwing in a lot of faults on serve, actually, and maybe just think that she just wanted to get out of there, to be honest. But at the same time, Kontaveit was playing really, really well, full of confidence, and she just blasted Muguruza off the court, which you don't really say happens that often. I can't really think of many scorelines where I've seen Muguruza so kind of comprehensively outplayed.
Yeah, she doesn't often get thrashed. She's not one of those players that would capitulate and, you know, not be able to get a ball in court. So a bit out of character. You know, she can blow hot and cold, but perhaps not to the real, you know, extremities. And she had struggled to get past Martinkova in the first round. But, I mean, Sabalenka also didn't have a particularly great week. She lost to Alexandrova. Halep as well, losing to Sakkari. So, you know, a couple of the other top seeds and big names, not you know, getting through beyond the quarterfinals and such like. But, you know, regardless, some great tennis on show. It was a very close final. So all in all, good tournament. And it makes it very exciting with this sort of Jabeur Kontaveit, you know, who's going to get their battle.
I know. And as I said, I do think with on Jabeur, she has played a lot of tennis. And I think at the moment, yes, I know she is really committed, obviously. She really wants to be there. You can sense that. She really wants to be there for the end of season finals. But I just feel like she's played a lot of tennis, and maybe that's that caught up with her in Moscow. You know, she retired 6-1, one love down to Alexandrova. I think she's got I think it was due to her elbow, and that's the reason why she's not playing this week as well. So I wonder if tennis has caught up with her a little bit. And, you know, I think that's what's so, you know, one of the aspects of, you know, the end of the season, why it's so fascinating, is that it's not like the start of the season where everyone is fresh. Everyone is, I think there are top players who are tired, and it opens up, I think, these kind of opportunities for potentially, like, you know, fresher players to come in and make, you know, make a name for themselves. And I think that's what Alexandrova did here by getting through to the final, because, you know, she beat Sabalenka, the top seed, and that was very, very impressive. I know Sabalenka's just come back from a bout of COVID, and you know, she spoke about the fact that, you know, it sort of wiped her out for the first 4 days. But yeah, very good win, I think, for her against the top seed. And I think for Sabalenka, yeah, she'll be looking to get some more matches in before the end of season finals, because, you know, it's not necessarily a done thing. I think coming back, I think we saw that with Dan Evans, for example. It's quite takes a few tournaments, I think, to just get back into that rhythm. And I think this tournament, I think, was probably a bit of a learning process, I think, for Sabalenka in that respect.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I feel like this year for everyone, not just professional tennis players, it's been very tiring. It's been, you know, a very emotional roller coaster, what with the pandemic, you know, that's ongoing. And also, you know, for these players, they've been going around traveling in bubbles with various restrictions and protocols they have to follow. Probably is a bit more mental fatigue going on than normal, what with everything, you know, it's been so definitely up and down. And obviously there's all this chat about, you know, vaccinations for players, and it's, you know, there's so many kind of differences compared to a normal season pre-pandemic. So perhaps we are seeing a bit more, you know, ups and downs with various players and scorelines. And I mean, let's touch on Tenerife, Joel, now, because we were saying last week, looking ahead to this, that, you know, Svitolina was far and above, you know, the top seed. Like, if you looked at, you know, no offense, but the caliber of the other seeded players in the draw, you know, Svitolina was sort of almost a dead cert to go deep. But
and
lo
what
and
happens?
Behold,
I know.
Yeah, she loses in the first round. But to be fair, she lost to Maria Camila Osorio Serrano, who made it all the way to the final and is herself having a real breakout season. And she came through against Svitolina in three sets and, you know, went on a bit of a run, which is great for you know, the Spanish fans having a, you know, she's Colombian, but, you know, her Hispanic player who, you know, up to this point has been most notable on a clay court. But it's great that she's like transferring her abilities onto a hard court. And she missed out to American Ann Lee in the final, who came through 6-1, 6-4, just over an hour to get well, her second title of the year, or perhaps her first.
We were having debates about this, weren't we, before recording, because it's sort of like 1.5, isn't it, in terms of titles for the year for Ann Lee, isn't it?
Yeah, because she and Annette Contefe, actually, they've both won this week. They both shared the title, I think it was the Grampians Trophy in Melbourne, which was that extra tournament they put on before that AO. And they couldn't play the final because I think, was it terrible weather? So it got delayed or something or other happened. They couldn't play, so they shared the title. So I don't know if that's officially gone down as like a title or not, if it's like a half title. But I mean, Ann Lee will be really pleased to have actually won a full title now. And actually, both her and Osorio Serrano have had amazing years, because respectively, you know, this time last year they were sort of ranked in the 100 to 200 bracket and they're now just outside the top 50. So both like half their rankings in the last year and made a few finals. And, you know, it was Ann Lee that was able to come through in the Tenerife final. Just a bit more power on the day, I think, coming through. And Osorio was trying all the drop shots in the world, but wasn't quite coming off. And, you know, Ann Lee making the most of those errors that Osorio Serrano was committing. But, I mean, also interestingly, Joel, you know, what with Osorio Serrano, I feel like we don't need to say the Serrano anymore. I believe she's dropping the Serrano from her name. Is that correct?
Yes. So I think, I could be wrong, but I get the impression that I saw this on social media that she is now just going to be, for WTA purposes, it's just going to be Camila Osorio. So we don't have to go through the full name anymore. We don't have to call her like MCOS, you know, we're not going to give her like a PCB style three letter name. She's just going to be Camila Osorio. But as you said, I think, you know, I was sort of surprised actually at the final, because, you know, Osorio Serrano beat the top seed, and then she beat Camila Giorgi as well in the semi-final. And that felt, that I watched that match, that was very much death by drop shot. It did feel borderline a little bit excessive at times, but you could see that you know, that Giorgi was getting particularly frustrated. She didn't really, you know, she just wanted a battle from the baseline, and Osorio Serrano wasn't giving her that. And, you know, actually one of the things I love about her game is the variety that she can bring at such a young age. And I think that's what's doing, I think that's what's working really well for her, and has enabled her, I think, to kind of climb up the rankings. And I do think that, you know, we're seeing a trend of players that are able to kind of go up the rankings or win titles. You know, I'm thinking, you know, at the very top, like Ash Barty, they can bring a variety to their game, on Jabeur as well, that can kind of mitigate anyone who has a sort of power game from the baseline, like a Camila Giorgi. Then it was really, I think it's a real hot commodity, I think, in the WTA Tour at the moment. And I think that was one of the reasons why she got through to the final. I was just a bit surprised actually that Anne Lee won so easily, 6-1, 6-4, because yeah, I would have thought that Osorio Serrano was going to be in really high confidence, really confident mood, given, you know, having taken out the number one seed and the number four seed. But, you know, to give credit to Anne Lee, she played a fantastic match. And again, she's a player who's playing with so much confidence, as you would expect for a player kind of rising up the rankings. Both players have had very impressive seasons this season. And I think, you know, they'll use this season and all the learning experiences from it and take that into, you know, well, take it into kind of their future and see where it can go, because I certainly don't think that, you know, they're done just yet. They can go even higher. And for American tennis, it's another, you know, it's another name, I think, to add to the growing list, both on the men's side and the women's side of players to look out for. But yeah, really impressive victory from Anne Lee. I did notice, Kim, match point, bit of a weird one. And listeners, if you want to look at this, go on to YouTube and watch the highlights. But it was like a mid-court smash, and it was like the game is up for Osorio Serrano match point. So she decided to kind of wave her arms about, which looked like for some fans, it looked like she was trying to distract Anne Lee. And, you know, trying to put her off. I just thought, you know, she was holding her hands up in terms of saying like, oh, the jig is up here. You know, I've lost the match. But yeah, I noticed some fans think that, you know, it was a bit of potentially underhand tactics. I know you were sort of describing it as a bit like Jerzy Dudek in the Champions League final for Liverpool.
Yeah, I'm not sure how relevant that analogy is, but sort of waving your hands in the air, trying to potentially distract your opponent, just made me think of him on the penalty line in that sort of critical shootout.
I would have thought it would have been really interesting to see if Anne Lee had lost that point, or she put the smash into the net, what the umpire would have done. Because I would have loved to have seen, imagine winning a tournament on a hindrance call. I don't feel like that happens very often.
Well, Anne Lee was very cool, calm and collected, so it didn't get to her, whatever Osorio was trying to potentially do down the other end. But yeah, really great for Anne Lee. You know, there were only two seeded players that actually made it through to the second round. So to come absolute through and make most of of an open draw is like all you can ask for, really. And just a note on Svitolina, Joel, obviously she didn't have a very good good time in Tenerife, but she's just announced that she's split from Andy Bettles, who is her longtime coach, former guest on The Passing Shot. And unfortunately, yeah, they've ended their five-year partnership. And, you know, it sounds like it's ended, you know, amicably. She's wished him well. And I think, you know, perhaps it just had run its natural course. And, you know, she has been quite up and down of late. So I think perhaps she's just looking for some new guidance, new direction.
Yes, I agree. I think it's one of these situations where, as you said, I think naturally it was coming towards the end. Svitolina, let's be honest, has looked a shadow of her former self this season. It's been quite up. There's been ups, there's been some ups, but there's been, I think, a majority of downs. And although I think, you know, this season will be, I think, memorable for her, because of, you know, getting engaged and having a wedding to, you know, her partner, Gael Monfils. And I think, you know, that would have bring her obviously lots and lots of happiness and joy. I think she'll be remembering it for that as opposed to kind of her performances. And, you know, watching some of the highlights against, Osorio Serrano. I mean, I think she was, you know, she had won the first set. She was looking good, but yeah, she just seems to be getting in this slump at the moment. And we know that when Svitolina is on, she's a very good player. And, you know, it wasn't long ago we were talking about, you know, when she's going to break through to reach her first Grand Slam final. But it just unfortunately seems at the moment that she is quite far away from that. And perhaps she does need a bit of a reset and a mindset change. And that might come with a new coach. So I certainly feel that, although it's, you know, it feel quite sad, you know, they've developed a quite a good and long-standing relationship, as you said, over kind of 5 years. I think it does feel the right moment for both of them to kind of reassess and look what's out there. And I think for Svitolina to understand, well, how do I get back to being the player that I was? Because although I think her ranking is, I still think she's around sort of top 10 or near enough about, she certainly doesn't feel like she's playing like it at the moment.
Yeah, I think having that fresh kind of connection with a new coach might be, you know, hopefully that will unlock whatever it is that she needs to go that extra step. And we may find in the new year that it's a news for Selena. So wishing her all the best, you know, with whatever she decides to do coach wise. I mean, let's look at the men's tournaments, Joel, from the last week as well. Two men's tournaments. We also had the Kremlin Cup, you know, male edition ATP event, which was won by Aslan Karatsev, so home favourite, second seed. And he came through against Marin Cilic, who I think I had said would have a good week. I think I got that one fairly all right in our sort of tentative predictions last week. But Karatsev kind of dominated the final, 6-2, 6-4. That's his second title of the season, you know, and this is obviously his breakout season as well. Yeah, he was very strong in the final, you know, it hasn't dropped a set en route to this title. You know, beat Khachanov in the semis. One of your faves, Jill Simon in the quarterfinals. Quite interesting seeing Jill Simon back in a quarterfinal.
I know. That was a bit of a throwback. I wasn't really expecting that from the men's Kremlin Cup. But yeah, it was very good, I think, for Karatsev. I mean, looking at the draws, Kim, I'm not gonna lie, looking at Cilic's draw, like Tommy Paul, Pedro Martinez, and then Ricardus Barrancas, lucky loser in a semi-final. That feels like a bit of a gimme to get to the final. So I feel like he had quite a nice route and was aided by a really surprise result that I was just caught me off guard. I think it caught a lot of people off guard. Andrei Rublev, top seed, first match, Adrian Mannarino, goes and loses it in three sets. I was very, very shocked by that. And maybe it would have been completely different if that had changed. But yeah, I don't know what happened there. Rublev in front of his home crowd. Normally, I would be a bit of a banker there against Mannarino. But yeah, bit of a surprise. And I was kind of thinking he was the Russian that maybe was going to end up as the champion. But it was, it was Karatsev.
Yeah, that Mannarino match, very odd. Mannarino for me is like the ultimate journeyman. Like, I just don't see any danger in his game when he just doesn't seem like the sort of player that's going to... I mean, yes, of course, he can upset anyone, I suppose, on his day. But I just, you know, perhaps it's not that shocking, but it's just like, oh, really, Rublev, that's what you went and did this week? But
because you think he's such a bully of those sorts of players. You just would have thought that he would just come through... In straight sets. I mean, we saw Mannarino at Queens, didn't we? On court one against Liam Brody, actually, wasn't it? And yeah, you didn't really sense he has too many weapons. I know he gave. I think he was a little bit unlucky against Roger Federer actually at Wimbledon, because they had that match which was quite tight for probably a longer and more extended period of time than I think Fed fans would have hoped. But yeah, a bit surprising there. But it was a good result, I think, for Russians. Not the player I was sort of expecting, but an interesting fact, Kim, about Karatsev and the fact that he has won. He has become the first male player to reach multiple tour level finals in each of singles, doubles and mixed doubles during the season since Mark Woodford in 1992, which it reminds me, because he obviously had his breakout at the Australian Open in the singles, but he's developed his game this year to become really a man for all formats on the tennis tour.
A man for all seasons, all formats. Whoever you put him on a court with, he's going to get to that final. No, it's good for him. Like, he's had a great year, and I hope his good run of, you know, success continues and he sort of becomes a consistent figure.
I mean, that is a very good thing to have, I think, for what, with Davis Cup coming up. Very much a linchpin of a team, in the sense that he can do it all. And I think those players are a bit of a premium, aren't they, when it comes to things like the Davis Cup. You know, I think we've spoken about Jack Sock, for example, being an example of one of those players who, maybe not necessarily on the level of Karatsev, but you'd certainly say he's got singles credibility and doubles credibility. But certainly, yeah, Karatsev is making a name for himself. He's made a name for himself this season in singles, 100%, no doubt, given where he was like a year ago, outside the top 200 and now into the top 20. But I think more impressively is the fact that his versatility, and the fact that, you know, I think it just is a credit, I think, to his game and his variety, that he's just able to apply it to any sort of arena.
Yeah, and we look forward to all the players we'll discover in the year that comes, because obviously with this time last year we hadn't heard of Karatsev. So I'm excited for which names it is that will emerge next year that, you know, we're not aware of. So we'll see who does a Karatsev next season. Great for Karatsev. We also had the Antwerp event in Belgium, which obviously we saw Andy Murray. We'll get onto him in a little bit. And this was very much a, you know, the seeds kind of going to form in the final anyway. Top two seeds, Sinner and Schwartzman battling it out in the final. I think we did say that Sinner was on, you know, looking good for this event. And he had a fantastic week, didn't drop a set on his way to the title. Very comfortable in the final, 6-2, 6-2 against Schwartzman. Yeah, basically just strolled through the tournament.
His last five sets were 6-2. it was absolutely ruthless. You do look at his game and think it is tailor-made for an indoor hard court. And Schwartzman in the final, he was playing some really good tennis this week, and he just did not have an answer to Jannik Sinner, who was really kind of coming out on top in all departments. Really, he was really aggressive on the, you know, on the return, particularly I think on the Schwartzman second serve. He was just firing winners left, right, and centre. It was just, again, so impressive from him. I think he's still got an outside chance of being at the Turin end of season finals for the top eight. He will be there, I think, for the next gen finals, but I think probably you will have greater ambitions. But yeah, another title. I think he's now the youngest player to claim five tour titles since Novak Djokovic did as a 19-year-old in 2007. So he's in great kind of stature there. And it's just crazy. This season, again, has just been a very, very, very impressive season for him in terms of racking up the titles. Maybe not necessarily in terms of ranking. You know, I feel like it's been quite steady, but at the same time, the number of titles he's just racking up, it's just crazy good for a 20-year-old.
I feel like Felix Auger-Aliassime is looking at Sinner like, how are you doing that? How do you win a final? Sinner and Hercaj, and I think Casper Ruud, even Cam Norrie, I think they're very close to that final spot. And, you know, they're all playing in Vienna this week. So there's a lot up for grabs. And Sinner is one of those players that, you know, it will be all guns blazing trying to get that spot. Great week for Sinner. You know, he just continues to impress. And other notable events from this week in Antwerp, that Andy Murray Francis Tiafoe match. Did you watch it all, Joel? You're still watching it.
Oh my God. That was an unbelievable war of attrition. I mean, it was such a fantastic match. Obviously, I'm an Andy Murray fan, but what was it? 3 hours, 3 hours, 42 minutes.
Something
45
like
minutes. Yeah, it was the longest best of three set match on the tour this year. I think it was a first for Andy Murray in the sense of he's never played a best of three set match with three tie breaks, which you consider all the things he's accomplished in his career. That was still a first for him, which seems incredible. But it was just such a fantastic match, played in the right spirit. There was a nice little like man hug at the end as well. All the crowd were loving it. I was sort of a bit sad that, you know, TFO had to kind of go off court as the loser, but you know, you could see afterwards he did a really nice kind of Instagram post, just kind of commenting on the match, commenting on Andy Murray. It was just such a fantastic watch. And it was such a tight match. And you know, for Andy to come through that was, you know, really impressive. I know we always talk about the metal hip and we should not forget that. I think that match alone just shows you where he's physically at the moment. And I think you can say that he can now hang physically with the tour. I think that match shows it. I still think in terms of tennis ability, particularly with the top players, there is arguably some more work to be done there, because you know, he came up against Diego Schwartzman following that match in the second round, and you know, he lost again in two quite tight sets, but it really does seem to be a problem at the moment for Murray of of kind of closing out the big points, and particularly tie breaks, because he's not really had a good run with tie breaks, kind of coming back from his operation against, you know, really high caliber kind of top 20 ranking players.
Well, you say that, but then he won two against TFO and won that very tight match. Perhaps being a bit harsh. But yeah, I think after that Schwartzman loss in the next round, you know, he lost that 6-4, 7-6. He was sort of saying that he just, you know, the decision making wasn't quite how he wanted, especially in that second set. And he really needs to sort it out, because also ultimately, you know, he wants to be winning and he may play very well, but if you're not coming away at the end of the day with that win, you know, it's you're not getting that progression.
It's a results business.
Rankings. Yep, exactly. Being very realistic there. But yeah, he has lost a few matches, yeah, this season. It sort of seems like those second set tie breaks, they sort of, or first set tie breaks, they, you know, if he could just perhaps get them and be on the winning side, perhaps, you know, some of those matches against the top players would have gone differently. But I think having come through that epic with TFO, I think that, you know, that was a great win and he did, you know, put it together when it mattered. So especially in that last set tiebreak, and no wonder he probably would have been quite tired for the next round. I'm, you know, after 3 hours and 45, I think generally speaking he should be quite proud of his week. But
I think that's what was so funny about it, because I was watching that match against Schwartzman, and I actually don't think energy levels or feeling tired was part of the conversation of why Andy Murray lost. You know, it was more Schwartzman was playing a really, really good game and Murray's decision making wasn't as good as it had to be. You know, there were a few shots, there was a smash that just went straight into the net, which he sort of aborted kind of midway through, that just made me think whether his shot making wasn't as good as it needed to be. And as a result, Schwartzman was just able to really kind of show off his kind of counterpunching capabilities. And even when kind of Andy Murray was on the front foot in a point, Schwartzman was just able to kind of do a complete role reversal. And I think that was what was quite interesting about that match. And it shows that, I think for Murray, that there is a little bit of a way to go. But at the same time, the closeness of the sets to me suggests that it's just around the corner. I know we've been saying this like the last few weeks, but it feels like he's coming to a point now where, you know, it will take one, I think, breakthrough tournament to kind of get him back. But hopefully that will come soon.
Yeah, it could be a mental fatigue thing. You know, being mentally tired affects your decision making, etc. I mean, I know when I'm tired, I have no idea what to do for dinner, for example. I cannot make a decision to save my life. So anyway, let's take a quick break now, but do join us in the second half. Got a lot more to talk about still, including all the updates for Wimbledon 2022, the latest vaccine news coming out of the Australian Open, and all of the events this week, including Vienna and also Emma Raducanu's debut in Transylvania. So do join us after the break. This is The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, supported by DownloadTennis.com. And now we're going to move on to the second half of the show, where before we get on to the news and previewing this week's events, we've got the return of a game, Joel. We have a par for the courts. I think you've got one for me. I'm very excited. We haven't done this in a few weeks, have we?
No, we haven't. And it's quite, I'm not going to like him. It's quite tough. I think it's quite tough. And listeners, I'm warning you as well. I think it's quite tough. I've got a par for the courts for you, Kim. I am going to give you, once again, going to give you a topic and I'm going to set a par score for you. I am hoping you don't do as badly as you did last time, because I'm pretty sure the last time we did this, you ended with a big fat zero because you were really confident about, I think you said, did you say Novak Djokovic? And he wasn't on the list.
Novak just messing it up for me. what the hell?
I know.
Hopefully I'll be a bit more conservative this time. But what have you got for me?
Right. So it's quite open, to be fair. Right. My question for you, or my topic for you, is there are 21 players who have a victory against all of the big four. So Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal, Roger Federer, and Andy Murray on the ATP Tour.
Okay.
And I want you to name me as many of those 21 players as possible. Now, I think this is quite difficult. I'm not going to lie. There are some funny names in this list. Names that I think you would be very surprised by, which will probably make you think that some of these happened earlier on in their careers.
Back in the day.
Literally, I'm just thinking one victory against Rafa, one victory against Roger, one victory against Novak, and one victory against Andy. So I'm going to set the pass score. So there's 21 in total. I'm going to be quite conservative here, and I'm going to say 5.
Okay. Yeah, I think
it's tough.
I can get 5.
Okay. I mean, you've said that we've been in this situation before. You've been confident and it's not worked out well, but I'm hoping it's going to work out well for you this time.
Yeah, I do think 21 would be real going some, but I think I can get 5. So, right, let's start without further ado.
Okay.
I am going to start with Stan Wawrinka.
Correct. Yes. Stan the man and his red shorts, whatever. Yep, they are in there. Yes.
Okay, great. Juan Martín Del Potro.
Correct. Yes. Juan Martín Del Potro is in there. So that's 2. So I'm looking for ideally 3 more.
So I'm just thinking, obviously, it's not just slams. It can be regular run-of-the-mill tournaments. It's obviously a lot easier to beat Djokovic on a Masters event, for example. I feel like Songa has beaten everyone at some point.
Correct. Yes. Songa is in there. Very good. Yes, he is on the list. So that's your third. So 2 more to get par for the court.
So I've got some other names that I'm bandying around. I'm thinking other French players like Monfils. I know he's definitely beaten Rafa. I'm sure he's beaten Federer and Andy, and probably would have beaten Novak in a smaller tournament. But I also want to say Thomas Berdych, but I'm thinking, did he ever beat Novak? I'm sure he would have done in some tournament. So I'm going to say Thomas Berdych as my next one.
Correct. Yes.
Yay.
Thomas Berdych is in there. I mean,
similar generation.
All of those victories. I mean, he did beat them. He did beat a few of those players, didn't he, at Grand Slams? But I feel like, yes, he was more of a tour force than a slam force, wasn't he?
So I'm going to go with Gael Monfils as well, as I've just been ruminating about him.
So this is for par for the court. This is for par for 5. The court. Gael Monfils.
Yeah. Mm.
Is that your final answer?
Oh, yes.
It's incorrect, Kim.
Oh, no! Has he not beaten Djokovic? Has he never beaten Novak?
Gael Monfils is not on the list. Oh, no.
Man. How about Marat Safin? I was thinking about saying him.
No Marat Safin. No.
Tommy Robredo?
No, Tommy Robredo. No. Oh. There are a lot of players in that era that you could have gone with. There are some current players as well.
I was going to say Dominic Thiem and Zverev, and they've beaten them all, haven't they?
If you had said Alexander Zverev, he was the most recent one to do it. So Zverev would have been correct. You could have said Andy Roddick.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Arnaud Clément.
I would not have said him, I have to say.
David Goffin.
Okay.
David Nalbandian. Yeah,
he beat them all, 3 of them in 1 week, mm-hmm. didn't he?
Dominic Thiem also you could have had. So yeah, Dominic Thiem.
Okay.
Fernando González. I'm not going to lie, I absolutely love this. Gael Monfils not on the list. Gilles Simon is on the list.
Really? Oh, blimey. Yep.
Grigor Dimitrov, Ivan Ljubicic, Kei Nishikori, Marin Cilic, Mario Ancic.
Oh, wow. Early days.
Nick Kyrgios.
Oh, Kyrgios, of course.
Nikolai Davidenko, Robin Soderling, Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Oh, I don't know why I didn't say more current players. I just went straight back to like 7 years ago, or that kind of era. Okay, yeah, if I didn't have that sort of all or nothing, I would have got more players, but obviously I went for Monfils way too soon. No, that's a great question. Listeners, how did you get on with that? I'm sure a lot of you were able to beat my score.
Yeah, anything over 10, I would be very, very impressed with that. I'm actually going to, after this, Kim, I'm actually going to go and look up all of Jules Simon's victories against the Big Four.
YouTube.
It must be on YouTube somewhere.
So we've got a mailbag question for this week as well, which is from Gail, not Gail Monfils. It says Gail, spelt G-A-I-L, who she got in touch with us on email and asked us this. So following the news that Bâle will be getting a certified Fed Express as a mode of transport, I assume, you know, to the tournament, which is coming up, what is the next form of transport you would like to see take on a tennis player's name? I love that. I mean, I'm surprised Bâle haven't had a Fed Express already, because it seems like an obvious thing to implement, what with the name.
Listeners, if you've got no idea what we're on about, just go onto Roger Federer's Twitter. You'll be able to see what we're on about. But basically, there's like a tram in Bâle, and it's got a branded Fed Express tram that is in the city centre. It's quite nice, actually. It's quite nice blue. It's got him hitting a running back, single-handed backhand. Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, he's looking quite dapper in his little jacket as well, with the promo of that. But what other transport would you like to be branded by a tennis player?
For some reason, my head went to, like, everyone seems to be having like a rocket to space at the moment for space tourism. So just for the purposes of it, it starts with S. I was going to have like Serena's space shuttle. I think she could, you know, once she hangs up a racket, I think she could go into the booming space tourism trade. And that's sort of where I got. I wondered if on Jabor as well, maybe she could have her own, like, maybe she already have, maybe her a Jabor jet plane. I feel like she goes to every single tournament around the world, that she could have her own branded aircraft just to take her everywhere. I feel like if any tournament organizer wants a star player, I think on Jabor should be at the top of their list.
Maybe Tunisian Air will sort of start thinking about that. Yeah, all I could think about was maybe like Benoit's bicycle for Benoit Paire, because I feel like a bicycle is quite a French thing as well, and I can imagine him cycling around.
I could see with his beard transport, just flowing downhill. Yeah, I can see that.
Exactly. I love that. I mean, you could literally... You could get quite inventive, couldn't you? Rafa's rodeo, perhaps. That would be quite interesting.
I think Rafa's more of a boat person, isn't he? Isn't he massive yacht?
He does like his yacht. So maybe he could, you know, venture out and have his own brand of yachts going forwards. But great question, Gail. Thanks so much for getting in touch. And do remember, listeners, you can reach out to us and ask us any sorts of random questions you like. We'll be happy to answer them on the show. But in other news, lots of chatter about Grand Slams this week. We've had some updates from Wimbledon and the Australian Open. So next year for Wimbledon, they sent out an email. A lot of our listeners probably have received it, but they've announced that there will be no middle Sunday, you know, off. They'll be playing on the middle Sunday. So the fourth round is being split across middle Sunday and second Monday. There's no Manic Monday anymore. They're also, sadly, they're moving the mixed doubles final to Thursday from the Sunday, which I think is a real shame. They're cutting the draw to only 32 pairs. They're moving it to earlier in the week, which seems the right shame to me, because often there's a Brit in that event and it's sort of like the final jewel to sort of enjoy as the Wimbledon fortnight comes to a close and you get, you know, get behind maybe a local. And having it on a Thursday just seems a bit of a letdown.
Yeah, definitely. That was the biggest sort of thing that jumped out of me at this release, because there were a lot of different sort of notes being made. But yeah, the fact that I just don't think a Grand Slam final should be played on a Thursday. I feel like ideally you'd have Grand Slam finals on a weekend, regardless of it's obviously singles or doubles. And we know that we've seen how, you know, fans love watching mixed doubles. They love the partnerships, they love the chemistry, they love seeing that sort of intergender competition. And when it's being played on a weekday, on like a Thursday, when, you know, majority of people are working, it might be in the early evening, but it just feels a bit of a missed opportunity to have it on a weekday as opposed to a weekend. I understand that, you know, there's going to have to be compromises made. And, you know, I think, you know, now we've got the ladies doubles final, which will now complete the tournament after the men's singles final instead, which I think would have been, that was traditionally where the mixed doubles final used to be. But yeah, it's just a bit of a shame because, as you said, like normally we see Brits, it's like normally it's like the biggest opportunity for a Brit to either make a name for themselves or, you know, go on a really amazing run. And, you know, for it to kind of end on a Thursday feels a bit of a whimper, really. And, you know, if it can go away to the weekend, it can, you know, raise the profile and raise the awareness. But, you know, I'm sure a lot of kind of thinking has gone into this. And as I said, I'm sure compromises had to be made somewhere. It's just a bit disappointing, I think, that, yeah, there wasn't a slot, I think, that mixed doubles could fill maybe on Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah, and they're moving the ladies doubles final to after the men's singles final, which is when the mixed doubles final would have taken place. I wonder if that's because it is quite a lot to have ladies singles, ladies doubles, men's doubles all in that Saturday. But anyway, I mean, it's, you know, there will be there will also be a queue back for on the day tickets, but I think there's also going to be online ticket sales as well. I think it's going to be a bit of a hybrid, perhaps. But obviously there'll be a lot of people's balloted tickets from 2020 will be transferred over to next year, except I guess for that extra Sunday, they're going to have a little ballot for those. I don't know. But we will see how it goes. It's just, yeah, exciting. We've heard some updates already for next summer. Yes. It seems such a long way off, but it will be on us before we know it.
Yeah. But I think, you know, looking overall at the draw, you know, that sort of symmetry of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, I feel like it makes it a lot even, and maybe it will also help with the kind of the courts and, you know, how much pressure is being applied each day. And we're not having, I think we're over Manic Monday. And, you know, I know, I remember kind of a few years ago, the US Open was sort of infatuated with trying to make sure, I think, the men's semi-finals were on both on the Saturday or something. And it just didn't work. You know, it was felt more of a marketing ploy as opposed to like, is this in the players' best benefits? And I think sort of Manic Monday has kind of seen the sort of extinction, same sort of fate, I think, as well. And I think fans, you know, are more for it. I think, you know, it makes sense having more tennis on a weekend. Just feels a bit like of a bygone era having the Sunday off. So yeah, I'm glad to see that in place. And yeah, got me a little bit excited about, yeah, the fact that we're going to have kind of tennis across the whole 2 weeks in 2022 for Wimbledon.
Indeed, and the return of the queue. So watch the space.
You can deal with the queue. I'm not about that life, but you know.
Yeah, you who have never queued. How would you call yourself a tennis fan?
Oh my anyway. God. Maybe you'll drag me to the queue next summer.
Live updates from Joel and the queue. But the Australian Open have announced also some news, and that is it's looking likely that there will be a vaccination mandate for all the tennis players coming in to the country. The Premier of Victoria has said that he doesn't think that it's likely that a tennis player will be able to get a visa to come into play unless they are vaccinated. If they weren't vaccinated, they would probably have to do the quarantine again. So either way, if you're a tennis player, you're going to need to be vaccinated or you're going to have to be prepared to do the quarantine, which obviously a lot of players found incredibly difficult this year. So obviously there's a lot of hoo-ha about who has not been vaccinated, especially Novak Djokovic. You know, has he had it done yet? But he's not wanting to reveal his vaccination status. It may not matter. We may never know because it may not be needed, for the tournament. Although I suppose if we find out that he's doing 2 weeks of quarantine, we could probably guess, if it does come to the fact that they will allow players in if they're unvaccinated, but they'll have to do the quarantine. So yes, it's all still up in the air, but it does look likely that they are going to have some sort of protocol in for the Slam.
Yeah, it's a funny one because we're getting kind of conflicting information. It's just like information from different sources. And although kind of the Victoria Premier of kind of saying, you know, you're going to need to be vaccinated in order to play the Australian Open, we did have a leak that was kind of reported by Ben Rothenberg on Twitter about the fact that WTA players have been told that unvaccinated players will be allowed to play, but they must do so with a 14-day hotel quarantine, which I imagine would be like before. So it's a bit interesting to see. Obviously, the WTA players are getting fed this information from, you know, the WTA, and that makes sense. But it sounds like potentially further down the line, Victoria, the state of Victoria, might have other plans that that sort of supersede, I think, whatever the ATP and WTA say. And I think that is the biggest question mark at the moment. I don't, you know, I think the WTA and the ATP, they can offer this kind of guidance in terms of, you know, what they want to happen. But it feels like whatever the state of Victoria want to do is what's going to happen. And that would be applied to the event of the Australian Open. And I think that's where the biggest question mark and uncertainty, I think, is for players at the moment. Because if that does happen, then yeah, it does sound like it's either vaccination, double vaccinated, or you're not playing. And then players will have to make a decision in terms of whether they decide to play the Australian Open. And I think that will be, you know, that will be a big moment in terms of understanding who is ready to commit and say, okay, yep, this is a Grand Slam, I want to play it. Therefore, although I've had these sort of reservations maybe about vaccinations in the past, I want to play tennis, therefore I'm going to do it. And, you know, maybe players like, for example, Sabalenka, who's had it and said, you know, yeah, it wiped me off the floor for 4 days. Maybe she's going to have different thoughts about it. But yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be interesting. It's coming. It's not going to be something, I hope it's not something, well, it won't be something that will be last minute. You know, players are going to need time for these vaccinations to happen. You know, what, it's like 6 weeks, 7 weeks to get both jabs and having the appropriate sort of delay period between the two. But yeah, it feels like a bit of a drama at the moment, given the sorts of updates we're getting from all the different sources.
Indeed, and we'll have to just wait for further announcements. Mm. But at the moment, yeah, that's the situation. So there's so much like speculation, isn't it? Who has not had the vaccine? And, you know, fair enough, you don't have to like post about it and brag, or, you know, post a selfie of yourself, you know, getting the vaccine. But, you know, similarly enough, you know, should it be a state secret, someone asks, I don't know. But we'll wait and follow to see what news we get.
I mean, Kim, the other thing as well is that this could set a precedent for Grand Slams as well. You know, we're seeing, for example, in the NBA, in the basketball, there's a player, I think for Brooklyn, who doesn't, you know, he's a very good player, but he doesn't want to get vaccinated. And because of the NBA saying you must be vaccinated in order to play, he's just kind of sitting out the tournament. And, you know, if this potentially could be a precedent, then I don't know. Maybe there would be examples of players having to sit out on the tour. I know that might be quite drastic and I wouldn't expect that, but we'll have to wait and see in terms of how next season starts. We're still not through winter yet, and, you know, we've got the Transylvania Open coming up, and that's been told that it's going to be being played without lots of fans. So I think there's still lots of time for things to, you know, to happen, and, you know, in lots of different countries. So yeah, it's definitely one to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. So let's look at what events are happening this week. As we mentioned, we've got Vienna, where we've got, you know, a lot of the top names. We've got Tsitsipas and Zverev there. We've got Sinner, you know, recent Antwerp champion. We've got Matteo Berrettini, FAA, Casper Ruud, Schwartzman. And this is, quite a ridiculous draw, actually. It's not really any easy matches, except I think you've pointed out Denis Novak versus Gianluca Magyar, which is perhaps the easiest of the first round picks. But yeah, we've got a lot of title winners from this year in the draw. And obviously, you know, we've got the likes of Casper Ruud, Jannik Sinner, Hercash, all going for that kind of final spot. Also Cam Norrie, you know, final spot in Turin. So all up for grabs. Andy Murray has also been in action already as we're recording this. Again,
he's just had a match point, Kim. And then he's lost the second set. He's had a match point and then lost the second set.
What were we talking about earlier? You know, him coming close.
And hilariously as well, the two set scorelines were 6-4 and 7-6. So, again, it's just another example, I think, of how close, you know, Murray is pushing these top guys. You know, players who are, you know, have strong hopes of getting to Turin. But, you know, it's a results business and he's not getting the results at the moment. And it's in a third set, and unfortunately Hercash is just going to break up straight away, one love. So yeah, we'll have to see how that goes, but yeah, very, very tough draw. Not really any sort of easy matches. And yeah, I mean, Tsitsipas Dimitrov first up. I mean, Dimitrov's in great shape at the moment, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit of an upset there potentially. You know, we'll see. But yeah, I mean, we've had some results already. Dan Evans lost to Carlos Alcaraz. So Alcaraz will play the winner of Murray or Hercash, which, you know, could be a rematch. I mean, if Murray was to come through, that would be a rematch with Alcaraz from Indian Wells. I think Basilashvili as well went through today, Kim, against one of your favourites, PCB. Obviously Basilashvili had quite a good run in Indian Wells, so yeah, a lot of decent players there, a lot of decent players in good form, a lot of players there, you know, wanting to get that last spot as well to the tour finals. So it could shape up to be a really fun tournament, given all the permutations I think that are possible.
Absolutely, yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. We've already had Carlos Alcaraz beating Dan Evans as well. So yeah, it's very exciting tournament this week in Vienna. We've also got the St. Petersburg Open in Russia, where Rublev is headlining that one. And obviously Karatsev's there. Shapovalov is the second seed. I wonder if Andre Rublev will have a better week this week than he did in Moscow. He hasn't got the easiest first round though. It could either be Laszlo Zsér or Ilya Ivashkin. Ivashkin's been pretty decent this year, like with a few sort of big wins, but otherwise, you know, Karatsev might be on for a double, so I feel like, you know, it's either going to be one of them two again, or maybe Shapovalov coming through, maybe Kachanov. I feel like it's looking likely for some sort of Russian victory.
You know, Marin Cilic might be quite dangerous. Unseeded there, yeah. Could face Kachanov in round two, so I wouldn't count out Cilic just yet. And Taylor Fritz as well, I think, is a player who, again, has been playing some very, very good tennis recently. So a lot of decent players there. I wouldn't be surprised if, yeah, Fritz or maybe Karatsev. See how Rublev does, but yeah, kind of interesting tournament there. We've also got the Courmayeur Ladies Open in Courmayeur, Italy, which is a WTA 250. Now, Kim, the draw here has been an absolutely over the place because of various withdrawals. I think Onjabor was meant to be the top seed, dropped out due to an elbow injury. Camilla Giorgi also dropped out. Anne Lee is there, so it'd be interesting to see if she can, you know, back up her form in Tenerife. I mean, it's quite an open draw given, Onjabor dropped out last minute. I think Yastremska, for some reason, is at the top of the draw and she's gone through. But again, it's a really open draw. Clara Torsen, you know, could be quite interesting. You know, she, again, is one of these players I think has had a very, very good season as a youngster. She might want to look to kind of cap it off with a title in Italy. But yeah, it's... I think it's a draw that, yeah, has been sort of suffered from withdrawals more than anything. And that, I think, is going to open up an opportunity for someone maybe we've not even heard of to go through and win the title.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's all to play for, really, in there with all those withdrawals. And we've also, I guess, the main women's event on everyone's mind will probably be the Transylvania Open because of Emma Raducanu playing and also Simona Halep. So,
and also because it's Halloween.
And oh yes, it's Halloween and it's Transylvania. And I feel like we said this last year if it happened, but I feel, you know, Transylvania is very well known for like Dracula and it's all kind of got that vibe going on. Unfortunately, yeah, there's been some last minute withdrawals from here as well. I think Muguruza, Badosa, Alexandra, they were all due to play. They've had to pull out. But I guess all eyes will be on Anett Kontaveit. You know, if she wins this tournament, I think she qualifies for Guadalajara. So she's the one to watch. Or, you know, I'm sure Simona Halep would love to end her season with a home title. And I'm sure Emma Raducanu would be loving, you know, the fact that, well, she, you know, she's, she, her father is Romanian. She'd love to probably get some wins under her belt at this tournament where she's obviously got a real connection to the locals. So, you know, and what can Camila Osorio do as well off the back of a final?
Yeah, definitely. I think the biggest shame is that, unfortunately, they announced a few days ago that there's going to be no fans there. You know, they were all gearing up. It's in a purpose-built stadium. And, you know, they were expecting to have fans in there. And I think it's probably caught them off guard a little bit, given how late it was. And I think that's a real shame, given some of the talent on show. So, yeah, I think that's the only sort of disappointing bit. It will be interesting, you know, from a British perspective, to see how Raducanu gets on. She's got Hertzog in the first round. I don't really know what to think anymore, Kim. You know, we were brought back down to earth, I think, in Indian Wells. So, you know, I think every match, you know, and every win, I think, from this moment on through to the end of the season is a plus. I mean, she is in Simona Halep's half. And, you know, we were talking about that matchup potentially happening in Indian Wells. It didn't happen. It could be a semi-final, but as I said, we've got to think with Raducanu. We just got to take it a match at a time now. And, you know, she's been speaking in the build up around the fact that she's having, I think, quite a few trials with different coaches. And, you know, it was interesting to hear her talk about actually she's learning to coach herself. And I quite like that, like, feeling of like independence. And, you know, obviously, you know, you're on a tennis court and you're on your own and being able to think for yourself as well. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how she gets on, given, you know, given what's happened, and I think given the, you know, the situations she's in at the moment with her coaching setup.
Absolutely, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how she gets on. And I think that brings us to a close, Joel, before we kind of go off to watch the rest of this Andy Murray Hubert Hurkacz match. See if Andy Murray can get over the finish line after being a setup. We'll be back next week as usual to round up all the action, you know, from all of the events happening this week and any other news on the tour.
I know, very exciting, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this latest catch up. Big, big breaking news as well. Kim knows this, and listeners, now you're going to know it. I'm going to be at the Billie Jean King Cup finals in Prague. As a fan, I'm there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So if there are any Passing Shot listeners out there and you're like, I really want to meet Joel from the show, I will be there with a friend. Kim sadly can't make the visit, but I will be there. Maybe I'll give a few live updates as well. But yeah, looking forward to that one. And we've got Davis Cup coming up as well. So lots of team tennis back on the agenda. But yeah, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this latest catch up with the Passing Shot. Remember to subscribe to us on your podcasting platform of choice. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Castbox, Stitcher, and all good podcasting platforms out there. And you can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. If you want to show your support for the show as well, then why not leave us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts?
And you can check us out on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter at Passing Shot Pod. So do get in touch. Give us a like and a follow if you don't already. You can also contact us via email if you prefer, passingshotpod@gmail.com. Or do check out our website, www.thepassingshot.co.uk.
And we will be back next week at Passing Shot HQ for the next round of tournaments on the ATP and WTA tours. How will Annette Contaveit do? Will she be able to make her way into Guadalajara for the WTA Tour Finals? Will Andrei Rublev be able to bounce back from his defeat against Manarino in St. Petersburg? We will soon find out, but I hope you can join us for our next catch up. And we will see you again soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.